yeah, I just loved exploring, you know, the world of acting and acting itself. So yeah, that's, you know, I thought I would grow out of it, Mark. I thought I would just kind of grow out of it. So I kind of went to school, finished school, and thought, oh, I'll grow out of it.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Back for another episode. How are you? I'm Mark Preston. If this is your first episode, thanks for checking it out. If you've been here before, thank you for coming back by. Most certainly appreciate it. How's things been going? You doing all right? If you're like me, you've got kids heading into summer vacation. I got my oldest back from college, which is super cool. I got the other two. My son just graduated high school, and the youngest is still, she's got a couple more weeks left of school. So I'm kind of pretending like I'm on summer vacation also. Anyway, glad to have you. Today, Rupert Evans, very cool to have him. He's a really wonderful actor from the UK. He's been in projects like Amazon Prime's The Man in the High Castle, The CW's Charmed, Netflix's Bridgerton, kind of a popular show you might have heard of. And he was even in Ewan McGregor's directorial debut, American Pastoral. This was a great chat. Really enjoyed sitting down with Rupert. We talked about acting, what it's like to kind of shoot projects on both sides of the Atlantic, and what it was like to work with Jean Reno, one of my favorite actors, one of Rupert's as well. That was a kind of a cool little note we touched on. And also the zen of a Land Rover. We covered a lot of ground. It was a great chat. By the way, don't forget storyandcraftpod.com, the website. You want to shoot me a message? By all means, head on over there. Social media links. You can also sign up for the newsletter. Anything Story and Craft is at storyandcraftpod.com. I appreciate the notes I've received from a few folks liking the show, spending a little time with me a couple of times a week. I most certainly appreciate it. All right, so let's get after it. It is Rupert Evans Day right now on Story and Craft. How are you, Rupert? You doing all right?
Good. Where are you, my friend?
I am located right now in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful.
No, I'm not a native here. I've been here about on and off about 20 years, but I guess I'm enough. I've earned my stripes in New Orleans, I guess. You're in London?
I am. I've just got back. Yep. I've just got back to from Vancouver. So, yeah, I'm back at home, which is lovely for me after many months.
You know, it's so funny. I was just speaking with someone yesterday. They're talking about filming in Vancouver. And from what I understand, that everybody that shoots there all stays. I can't think of the name of the hotel, but everybody lands at the same hotel. I think it starts with R, I think.
It's called the Sutton Place. The Sutton Place Hotel. Embarrassingly, I have just literally been living there for the last month. So there you go.
Well, how does it feel to be home now? That's the more important question. Are you feeling settled in yet, or is it still
It's been a long time. No. You know what? I've been away for 5 years. So
really,
I've just moved into my house after 5 years. It's kind of nuts, really, Mark, to be honest. So yeah, we're just unpacking. I'm living in a sea of boxes.
Oh, yeah. Now here's the thing. I've got this framed perfectly, so you can't see the shit that's on my right here. There's boxes and stuff and everything. I've made it look very presentable because I don't want to look at, gauche or anything. But isn't that funny? There's always like when you move somewhere, there's always some stuff that you don't know where to put it. It's like this fit in my last place. Where am I gonna? Then you start having this epiphany of like I got too much stuff. You know.
Oh my God! I've been Oh, no, that's exactly what's happening to me. I'm sorting through my life. It's just nuts. It's crazy.
Well, absolutely that begs crazy. The question, where were you living for the last 5 years? Were you just traveling around shooting, or were you living somewhere else?
No, Vancouver. I've been in Vancouver for five, 6 years.
Oh, so you were living in Vancouver. Okay. Is that where they shoot Charmed?
Yeah, and then before that was Man in the High Castle. It's just been sort of home for the last sort of... I've done 3 jobs in a row, just weirdly. Every time, I don't know. I don't know why. It's just that sometimes it goes in cycles, whether it's, I spent a lot of time in Budapest for a while, then Prague, and then Lithuania. And, it just sort of goes round and round in circles. And then
I'm seeing such a consistent trend. Budapest comes up, Prague comes up. Vancouver comes up. Seems like there are a lot of locations that are consistent. New Orleans used to be one of... Actually, it's coming back a little bit. Atlanta or Georgia's, where so much is happening that used to be more in New Orleans. It's so funny to talk to actors. They always kind of enjoy the ones that can come down here and shoot a series or something like that, because they can kind of play around a little bit. I found that if you're going to be somewhere for a few months, it's kind of good to be somewhere you actually want to be, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, New Orleans is really happening now. So, I have a friend who's a DP who's just starting on a job right now in New Orleans, a big show. So that's just starting. So I think things are happening. It's all about the tax breaks, my friend. It's all about the tax breaks. And it's whoever gives the biggest tax break.
Now, I have to be honest, I had to go catch up a little bit, Charmed. Of course, I'm a little bit myself, probably a little outside the age range of a lot of CW programming, although a lot of it's really good. Don't get me wrong. Went and checked it out, and I was like, man, this is kind of a fun show. I'm trying to remember, the original Charmed came out, was it like late 90s, I think? Was it late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I've never actually watched the original, so I can't remember, but it was huge. I mean, it was a big, you know, I think it went for 7 seasons, and it was... And it paved the way, didn't it, for us? So, it was certainly a hit show the first time around.
Now, you've had 4 seasons of this incarnation of Charmed, is that correct?
Yeah, I've just finished the 4th season.
Well, hey, in the world of TV, man, especially with streaming, going beyond 3 seasons, that's you're doing pretty well if you can do that.
Yeah, and we were very lucky because, you know, the pandemic didn't really affect us either too much. We had to wait a little longer to start up again, but I feel very lucky, very blessed, and you know, it's good fun, and they're very kind to me. And CBS Studios are very, you know, they're very passionate about this show, and they let me direct it as well now. So I've been directing it for the last 3 seasons. So it's been good fun, about acting and directing in a show and being a part of the creative process.
Really? But how many episodes per season are they?
I can only do one a season, because the prep that it takes, you know, you have to sort of literally take an episode off before, and then the episode you're actually directing is another one, and then the editing as well. So it actually takes up quite a lot of time. So it's hard for them to give me really any more than that. So we try and sort of, they finesse the schedule for me a lot to allow me just to do the one, to be honest. So it's been great though. I really enjoy it, and something I want to do again. So we'll hopefully I'll do more of it.
I've always been curious. I know for a regular theatrical release, you're looking at, I mean, you got to really budget a year of your life, you know, pre-production, production, post-production. How long does it take to kind of assemble an episode, get it ready, and then, you know, for you to shoot it? And then the second part of the question is, are you even involved, like the editing part of it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you would be amazed. You have a visiting director will have 8 days, 8, 9 days. We shoot 8-day episodes or 8.5-day episodes. So the next director will have 8.5 days to prep, to prepare, and then you'll have your 8 days to shoot. So it's, the turnaround is incredibly quick, and it's incredible. I mean, you know, the whole kind of setup, it's a huge machine, and you arrive, and the day you arrive, the first thing you'll do is scout locations, you know, get those set as soon as possible. You have casting calls that day, and instantly the machine, you know, starts, props, set design, you know, art director, you know, all those things, decisions have to be made really within the first 2 or 3 days about how are they going to do this and how are they going to break it.
You got to hope you have a really good team assembled already, I guess. Yeah, that's from what I, you know, like they say that movies are more of a director's medium, TV's more of a writer's medium. So I guess it's kind of like you're kind of jumping in a wave, it's already rolling.
Yeah, but you still have a huge amount of creativity and decisions have to be made as a director, you know, and that's the great fun bit. You have real say on, you know, when you get your episode, although you have no say, you know, about, you know, you do have some say, but, you know, you get given an episode. So you just no idea what the story is going to be for that particular episode. And that's kind of half the, you know, the trick, or, you know, part of the job is to kind of really be able to kind of carve out an interesting episode that you love, you know, from the script that you get, and you get so little time. So it's an incredible learning curve, and it's something that I've really enjoyed. It's where you learn how to direct, because you have to direct very quickly. You have to make decisions very quickly, instinctively. And it's really kind of seat of your pants. I always think that directing TV is like, you know, they give you a kind of very expensive Ferrari with gold sort of alloy wheels, and they say, "Right, here you are. Here are the keys, and it's the most expensive car you've ever been driven. You've ever driven, and you've got to drive it from this point to that point, and you got yeah, and you can't, and it, and I want to have it back with no scratches, you know, nothing wrong, in perfect condition." And they don't, what they don't tell you is that along the way it's going to be, you know, potholes, riots, screaming tears, but at the other end of it, you kind of, and then you have to give the keys back, and you know, so.
It's like once you get a few seasons in, everybody kind of has a good sense of who they are as a character, so you can you know how to honor that as you know, as opposed to trying to kind of alter, you know, characters and stuff. It seems like to me, if I was an actor on a show, and I've, I mean, I can't, I've, the stuff I've been on TV wise, series wise, I was a day or week player, you know, that's pretty much it. But when you're everybody kind of is in the flow, it seems like it's probably easy when you have a cast member directing because they already know the ecosystem and that kind of thing. Is that it, or do you get pushback because they do know you so well?
Well, I think actually, yeah, I think actually they're very accommodating, and I think the privilege of being a part of the show and then suddenly directing is that they, you know people, so you know, you understand them and they trust you. You know, a lot of actors, you know, I think acting directors, directors and actors, there's a trust issue. When visiting directors come in, it's really hard for them, you know, because they don't know anybody and you know, everyone's kind of judging you. So I think you're a kind of part of a winning team when it's like a home run, really. You know, everybody knows you, the camera department, particularly the DP, who's critical to your process as a director. So, you know, you're with the, you know, the team is with you. So certainly I think there are some, you know, there are some positives and about it, but also you're right. You know, you're trying to create something distinctive and some people know you so well, so they'll say, "No, I'm not going to walk over there because that's not what I," and I'm like, "Oh, please." But these things, you know, but ultimately, I think, you know, what's great is if you know the shortcuts. Do you know what I mean? Because you've been on the sets, you know the angles that work, camera angles that work, that don't work on certain sets. So for Charmed, we spent a lot of time in, you know, the Vera Manor, which is the house, and then the command center, which is this sort of vault cavernous kind of place underground. And, you know, you get to understand the camera angles and stuff and how it works and what looks best and how to play scenes. So, you know, that certainly has its advantages.
Are y'all having another season five, I suppose? Or is this the last season? Or?
Yeah, we're just waiting to hear. We're not sure. So the CW and the powers that be haven't made their decision yet. So there's a number of shows that are still waiting. It's not uncommon. So we'll find out. We'll see what happens, you know.
There is literally, and I've said this, anybody listens to my show, they know, it's like there's so much, I always say there's just so much stuff out there to watch that it's easy to let something slide through the cracks and it ends up being like down the line a weekend binge. I have not caught Bridgerton yet. It is probably, it's in the top three right now, but when I speak with people about Bridgerton, they're like, "Oh, dude, you got to see it. You just trust me, watch it, you know." What is that experience like to be on something that is kind of more than popular? It's like everybody's talking about it. What's it like to be on a show like that?
It's interesting when you join a show like Bridgerton. Again, you know, it has such a following and has a sort of cult following that, you know, there is a bit of like, "Oh, I wonder what, you know, the fans are going to think." But ultimately, you know, it's just great fun, and you know, it's such a privilege to join a show that's so successful and everybody's, you know, riding off that and happy and, you know, really striving to make the best show possible for the second season. You know, and I have a very, you know, I'm a small cog in the huge machine that is Bridgerton, but it was great fun. And the great thing about coming in to a show like that for me is that there's no pressure for me. You know, it's great. And I was able, and everyone was really lovely, really lovely.
You know, do you get on a show like that and go, "Okay, this is sort of kind of a period-based thing. Yeah, it's got to look at some contemporary notes, of course." Do you have preference in what you want to, in for as far as genre, what kind of stuff you want to dive into going forward? I mean, we'll call it the bucket list of kind of projects you would like to work on.
Oh my gosh, my bucket list. That's, yeah. You know what's? I think I often find with a lot of actors is that whatever they're doing right now is the one thing they don't want to be doing, and they always kind of hope to be doing something else. And I think the grass is always greener. So, you know, what was lovely about Bridgerton, for example, was just, you know, I haven't done a period show, a UK-based period show for a long time. So it was nice to get, you know, dressed up and, you know, Regency costume and all those things. You know, it was really, it was great, you know, and apart from the endless costume fittings that take, you know, days and days. But despite that, even that was fun, and it was great because you feel wonderful in the costume.
But isn't it kind of cool when you know that there's somebody there in the costume department that's actually gone stitched together, created something just for you, you know, which is...
Yeah. Yeah, and Bridgerton is an exception because they make every single costume. You know, I've done a lot of BBC period dramas before this, where you know they'll hire in, you know, a number of the costumes, but you know these guys literally make every single one, and it is incredible what they do. So, and I like, you know, Bridgerton. I like the sort of heightened reality. It's not professing to be, you know, sort of kitchen sink drama or, you know, realism. There's a heightened reality. There's a joy to it, and I really think that they caught something at the right time during the pandemic, and you know, and we all got sort of absorbed into it. And I just love it. It's a huge show, and as you say, in Netflix, it's the most watched English speaking show of all time on Netflix. So it's the most watched English speaking show of all time. So it's, you know, apart, and I think the biggest one is Squid Game. So I think it's sort of, it goes Squid Game, then it goes Bridgerton. So, you know.
A couple of my kids have seen that. But that is a show I really, really want to see. I saw the first episode. Another one I want to go back and revisit because I only got like two or three episodes in and, you know, life being life, you know, but as The Man in the High Castle, what a cool concept for a show. And please refresh my memory, kind of where did your character fall in that ecosystem of, of course, you have the Germans.
Well, listen, The Man in the High Castle is, for me, is very close to my heart. It was just, it's an amazing idea, you know, comes from the novel of the same name, a Philip K. Dick novel. And, you know, it's an alternative history show on Amazon, which, you know, kind of looks at the idea of what if, the Nazis, Germany, Hitler, what if they had won World War, you know, II? And so it's sort of, the whole show is set in, you know, in the 1960s, post-war America, under Nazi occupation. Well, actually, you know, half, you know, the east half of America is run by the Nazis,
it's
and
like Japan,
the west,
right?
Coast is run, yeah, by the Japanese. Yeah, it's Japanese. So they kind of join forces in this sort of alternative history show. And it's about life, you know, and my character is Frank Frink, and I play a sort of, you know, an American who, and I think it's quite alien to Americans, this idea that actually, you know, you are a subclass, but in West Coast, on the, you know, in San Francisco, under Japanese rule, but, you know, the all-powerful Nazis are certainly putting pressure on the Japanese to kind of eradicate all Jews and seek out those. And I actually, you know, my character is Jewish, and so that's the storyline. It was, you know, a very heavy storyline for me and for the show. So it was a fantastic, you know, job. And part of that, part of the book as well, is not only just an alternative history, and that is in itself enough. And it's so interesting if you watch it, seeing, you know, an American speaking Nazi. It's kind of extraordinary, having breakfast. It's kind of crazy idea that, you know, what happened, what if, what, you know, because there is a theory that, you know, that the Nazis weren't that far away from dropping a bomb on Washington, and were pretty close to that. So they were, you know, they were on the way.
It's kind of like, as much things change, they kind of stay the same, though, to kind of watch that in our current state of affairs in the world, is that same DNA of that Mr. Putin has is not, you know, it's connected to this.
Listen, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, absolutely. And so, you know, I think the show really tapped into something. And I think it was, you know, it came at a time where it was a really interesting idea for me, and I I love that show, and I love the idea, and there's also a sci-fi element to the show as well, which in the books it looks at as well, about sort of time travel. So it's a kind of extraordinary mix of sort of alternative history, time travel, and it's worth a look if you haven't watched The Man in the High Castle. It's worth a look on it.
I like I said, I think that's such a wonderful concept. I enjoyed, like I said, two to three episodes of watch. I'm going to go back. It's on the short list without a doubt. The Doorman, and without a doubt, I've got to ask, as I've always been a big Jean Reno fan, what got to go toe-to-toe and have him to be in scenes where he's the adversary, you know, what was that shooting like on that show?
Listen, I took that job just to be with Jean Reno, to be honest. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his, and he certainly didn't disappoint. He's an extraordinary guy. You know, he's not just an actor. He's a poet. He is so individual. He's an amazing human being. Really interesting guy. Very well read, you know, very articulate, very funny, you know, great fun. So I really enjoyed working with him, and it was really, you know, it was really fun. Yeah, he's an amazing man, amazing guy. He has a great depth to him, which, you know, and he has great range as well as an actor. You know, he can be dark, he can be, you know, intimidating, but he can be very light and funny. So it was real joy just to spend some time on set with him.
It was fun seeing him be the bad guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
The stuff I've seen, that there is American Pastoral, and just looking at the cast, I was like, how did I miss this one? Of course, Ewan McGregor, I don't know how I didn't know this. He directed a movie. I didn't know that, you know, but what's it like to be directed by Obi-Wan Kenobi? I got to know.
Yeah, this was Ewan's, you know, directorial debut. So this is, I think, a project that he had, you know, loved and, really had sort of fought for many years. It was great. He is one of the most generous men, Ewan McGregor. He's just very, you know, he's an actor's actor. He really understands actors, and you know, he has a vast experience now, but there is a sort of, there's a great childlike enthusiasm and love for what he does still, and that's what's so infectious about him, is that he still loves and cares about the work and people and actors. He loves being with actors. You know, he is an actor. He's an actor's actor. You know what I mean? He's got great stories. You know,
isn't that kind of the key to longevity, though? Kind of having that childlike. I mean, yeah. Maintaining enthusiasm, I think, has got to be one of the keys to longevity in this or any other craft.
Because 100%.
You can burn out 100%. Otherwise.
And, you know, yeah, and I feel, you know, every morning, when I go to work in Vancouver, you know, I feel very lucky. I love what I do, you know, and he certainly does. And he was great. He was a great, you know, he had done a lot of prep, a lot of work, and really understood what he was doing. So we had a great time on that movie, and you know, it was a really special little movie, and it was great. It was amazing, and Jennifer Connelly was great, and there were some wonderful people on it, so we had a good time.
Was acting and doing something theatrical always on the agenda, or was this a kind of discovery where you, when you were at university, kind of like, oh, I kind of dig this thing? What was the genesis of your theatrical pursuits, as it were?
I suppose, you know, I think I was just a sort of, I you know, we did a lot of acting at school, and then I think, you know, I got it. You know, I think I was a bit of a show off. I got, you know, I suddenly saw a reaction from people and I was like, oh God, you know. And I think it wasn't until a little later on, until I kind of, you know, I was sort of 15, 16, that I kind of realized that, you know, actually there's more to this and, you know, you have to be kind of quite serious about it. And, you know, and so I kind of always, I don't, yeah, I kind of, it grew. I think actually I couldn't do anything else. And I didn't want to do anything else. I really enjoyed it. And I just loved, exploring, you know, the world of acting and acting itself. So, yeah, that's, you know, I thought I would grow out of it, Mark. I thought I would just kind of grow out of it. So I kind of went to school and finished school and thought, oh, I'll grow out of it. You know, then I went to university and thought, well, I'll do a bit here, but, I'll grow out of it. You know, I'll do something else. And then I finished university and thought, what am I going to do? There's only one thing I want to do. So I then thought, well, I'll try and, you know, I'll apply to drama school. And then if I don't get in, then I'll just go do something else. And then I fortunately did get in. And then from there on in, that was it, really, you know. And it's the greatest job in the world. You know, you get to kind of see the world, meet crazy people, creative people. And, you know, if you get paid to kind of, you know, run around and pretend, you know, being chased by a ghost or something. I mean, I don't know. It's great.
Oh my God, being able to play for a living is one hell of a great gig.
Yeah. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. And I feel very fortunate. So yeah, that's kind of where it's, you know, it wasn't a great grand plan. I didn't want to do anything else and couldn't do anything else. So
was that encouraged by the family? Were they like, all right, well, he's, you know, Rupert's doing his thing. We're going to get behind it. Or were they like, oh, get a reasonable job. Come on now.
I think, you know, my dad sort of sat me down once and said, are you sure about this? Because, you know, if you, you know, the old adage of sort of 90% of actors are unemployed, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, ultimately, you know, they just sort of let you go, don't you? You know, they have to let you do what you want to do. So they didn't really have a say and they didn't really comment much. But they were always supportive. You know, they've always been great. Yeah.
So the what was your father's trade?
My dad, you know, my dad was in real estate, and he was an auctioneer as well. So there's a bit of sort of theatrical, you know, element to that. And having seen him do a lot of auctioneering, there's definitely an act that you put on when he steps on stage to sort of auctioneer. So I think, I think there was a bit of that in him too. I think I may have got it from him as much as my mom. My mom was certainly quieter, but she had a sort of ability to sing and stuff. So, you know, I have no idea really where it sort of came from, really why it sparked my interest in love.
Well, did you have any siblings, or were you an only child?
No, I have siblings. Yeah. One's in radio, actually does what you do, and is a DJ and broadcaster. On radio in the UK, and also my sister, you know, did a bit of acting for a while and does occasionally. So yeah, it's something in us. I don't know what it is. Really, it's just fun. You know, it's just great, great fun.
Is there something else that you were also considering while you were in school? You're like, okay, there's acting or there's this thing on the side. What was that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, well. Guys, when I started out, actually, I was like, you know, it was hard. You know, I didn't get, you know, I, there were long periods of unemployment early on, and you know, I was sort of waiting around. And I, at one stage, I was like so desperate. I thought, well, what am I going to do if this doesn't, you know, if the phone doesn't ring? What the hell am I going to do? So I thought, well, maybe I'll go into gardening. You know, like landscape gardening. So I did think about that for a while. I grew up on a farm, so I think you know, the outdoors has always kind of appealed to me. So I thought, maybe a quieter, simpler life, I'll go and sort of plant some vegetables and, you know, be a gardener. So that was one option. And then I have an absolute love for Land Rovers. I know it sounds mad. I have a love, Mark, for Land Rovers that I can't explain. Series 2A Land Rovers particularly. Or Series 3 Land Rovers, the older Land Rovers. And so if I had to give it all up now, I would probably just end up restoring old Land Rovers. Buy a garage, do them up, and sell them on.
Well, I know they use a Land Rover and the old, it was a 1979 Toyota, are the big ones they use out in the desert. They're the, like, iconic, I don't say desert, but, you know, off-road type things.
Yeah. I love old classic Land Rovers. So
it's kind of, in America, I guess it would be like an old Bronco is kind of the equivalent, I suppose.
Yeah, or a Jeep. Like a Jeep. You know what I mean? I love them. Yeah. So I mean, in fact, in America, they restore them. There's one company. Just outside New York, actually, in Connecticut, who restore a series two Land Rovers. It's crazy, to a very high spec. So there we go. Yeah. So I'm sort of a slightly obsessive Land Rover person, which is a kind of weird, completely nonsensical fact.
No. I don't think that's weird at all. I think there are many gearheads in the U.S. that would very much understand. Although they probably have different vehicle they're into.
Yeah. I mean, come on, North America is the home of the car. So, you know, you're right. You're absolutely
okay.
Right.
I grew up, my father ran car dealerships, Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, growing up. And it was so much fun because on the weekend, I didn't have a car yet. But I was, he would always let me grab a car off the used car lot because they had a new car and a used car and just whatever. So every weekend I was driving a different car. You know, I remember as like I saw the BMWs. I want to take a BMW. Of course, it was like, you know, midnight. I was broken down on the side of the road, and this BMW going, you know, I need something a little bit more robust, I suppose. You know, this was it was my first exposure to more luxury vehicles, and I realized I'm more of a truck SUV kind of a guy, I suppose. But that you mentioned before that, you know, you're thinking about the other things, gardening, farming, whatever have you. I got to know, what was the oddest job you had to hold? Keep the roof over the head, keep food on the table, you know, what was the, or maybe the most enjoyable job you had?
No, the oddest job is I worked in a freezer factory, frozen food freezer factory, like a frozen food, sorry, frozen food storage, distribution center for a big supermarket. And so you'd have to work through the night. It was like minus 56 degrees, and you'd be on one of those kind of like, I can't really explain, like a kind of forklift truck kind of thing. And it was, you have a list, a picking list, and you would go to aisle 83, row, number 80, aisle 83, row 5, and pick up like frozen fish fingers and put them in the back. And then when your cage is full, you then would go to the, the appropriate door and throw it into the truck, and off it would go to the supermarket. And that's, and I did this job. Oh my God, it was so brutal. And you would get frostbite, after a
Really, it
while.
was that
You
cold?
have gloves on, but it was, oh no, minus 56 degrees Celsius. I mean, it was so cold. And the whole, this huge, great kind of warehouse, huge distribution center was just for frozen fruit. That's all they did. And it was brutal. One of the hardest jobs. And the guys that worked there were really hardened. And you would have to start at like 3 a.m. and you would do like the night shift. And it was kind of a crazy time in my life where I met some extraordinary people there, really did. Yeah, real characters.
That kind of reminds me because when I, when I started in radio, it was an all night shift. And in my youngest, my 16-year-old daughter, we were talking. She's like, she seems to think it'd be really cool to work an all night shift. I was like, it's kind of cool to do it at least once in life. When you are on a different schedule to everybody else, it can be kind of cool, in its own weird way.
It's kind of crazy, and actually, it's weird because it always reminds me, that was a, really hard time in my life, and it was pretty brutal. And sometimes we do night shoots, and I remember doing, I was filming Hellboy in Prague, and we did like weeks and weeks of night shoots where you would start at 6, 6 p.m. and then you would go through, and we would finish at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then we would all go for beers. We would all kind of go to the pub just to get a drink after work. And it was kind of crazy going to have a drink at sort of 7 o'clock in the morning. These other people would sort of look at you like you're absolutely insane
Oh, I don't know. I
when you're
totally
sort of three
understand.
pints down.
I remember I was working at the apartment complex I lived at. I think I was 20, 21 years old, and I was working at a radio station all night shift. And I would get home, and like, the way I explained it to everybody is like, dude, just flip AM and PM. You'll understand my life. Just. It's the inverse. And so I'd come home. People would be 7 a.m. going to work. They're going to go do their thing. Walking by, I'm on my patio grilling a hamburger, at 7 a.m. with a beer. And they were like, they totally got it because they was like, okay, that guy works an all night shift. And then there was a couple other people that did something similar. And that, you felt like you're part of your own tribe. You got your own people that, understand your thing,
Definitely. Although I never kind of tolerated it, I never tolerated it. Sorry, I tolerated it, but I never really, really got used to it. You know what I mean? I never kind of completely like, I just didn't, it's always hard that, there's night shifts when you're working. It's crazy, crazy times, but yeah, sorry.
You just
You
realize
go
like
ahead.
you're there in the moment. You just got to adapt, and you're like, all right, I'm going to be here. This is where it's at. You can rage against it, but this is what you're up to. As far as like, if you're looking in the future, be it actors, directors, who would you like to work with? Who would you like to show up on set with? On a, work on a movie or TV show with.
Who's alive right now?
Who, yeah, absolutely.
God, that's such a difficult. You're putting me on the spot here. I don't know. There's so many different people I would love to work with. I mean, that I sort of gravitate towards sort of the older generation because I just think they'll have really great stories. I was very lucky. I worked with like, John Hurt. He had amazing stories. And Derek Jacobi, I've worked with a couple of times, and he has great stories. Michael Gambon has incredible stories, and I just love stories. As an actor, I think stories are for me. And I just love hearing old stories, crazy stories, of those sort of that generation. So I don't know, older actors probably, people who have sort of lived and experienced stuff,
Yeah, we're roughly the same age, and I'm thinking, that's one of those things. If I could isolate, as I speak to younger actors, voice talent, people that ask me questions like I know something, they're like, "What do you advise?" It's like, man, hang out with people with gray hair or less hair. They have better stories. It makes it more enjoyable. But there's a reason. If they're still around doing it, they know how to ride the wave, the peaks and the valleys. And I always said that the older guys had much. You're the only other person that's ever said that. They have better stories. I always say that. And then you start realizing the amount of shit they used to get away with, you know, all the mischief that used to happen back in the...
It is.
I love here. I could just sit back and I remember going to Denny's or some, one of those. Well, it's kind of like a diner, and sitting back with these guys who worked in New York. Back in my early. I worked in radio 1920, 21. These guys that worked in Toronto, New York, whatever. And the stories they would tell, like, oh my God, there's no way I could get away with doing that now. But you just soak it up and you start realizing, you know what? I'm allowed to have a little fun doing whatever I'm doing. You know, I got to make my own stories. You know,
this is true. But you know, I mean, funny enough, I was watching this show called Yellowstone recently. I don't know if you've seen it I think it's on Amazon. And I was watching Kevin Costner and I was like, Jesus, this guy is just, he's amazing. You know, he kind of, you know, he's been throughout my childhood. I mean, I was at school when he did Robin Hood, you know, and that was a, you know, and he just gets better and better. And I kind of suddenly thought to myself, I said, you know what, I would love to work with him because I think he's just great. And I was watching him, he gave a speech during the Oscars this year. And I just thought the guy, he had such a sort of calm presence. And I just thought that there's a guy who's been through it and, you know, such experience and just great. I would love to work with him.
I think he's knocking it out of the park in Yellowstone. But what do you have coming up as far as do you have anything in the can that's going to be coming out soon or anything you're going to be starting to work on? Or are you just basically unpacking right now and just calling that your primary gig?
I mean, I literally have just like 2 days ago got back. So it's been within 48 hours. So I'm still waiting. See what happens with Charmed, because we might be going back and doing that, which, you know, I'd love to direct more of that. So we'll see. And then Bridgerton's just coming out, really. So there's a lot to, you know, press to do for that and stuff. So at the moment, my life is just it's just that. And I am trying to get together a short film. So I'm hoping directing a little bit. And I've got a film that I want to try and get done at some point. So we're looking doing that. So yeah, there's lots kind of bits and pieces happening. But to be honest with you, having been away for 5 years, I'm just going to take a week off and then I'll get back to it.
Yeah, it's okay. Take a breath, man. Just kind of, you know, I think the fact you got two projects airing simultaneously, it's got to be cool, but it's also going to be a little exhausting. So I'm sure. Now, do you have a family? You have a partner, you know, you got kids?
Yeah, I have two kids downstairs and you can't hear them screaming, but they're two babies and my amazing wife. So yeah, we've been, I have two kids, two girls, 3 and 5. Yeah. So they're young. So they keep me pretty busy, to be honest. So, and that's a, you know, that's a very special part of, you know, as every dad's life, you know, it's an amazing.
It becomes your North Star. It really is the thing that calibrates every other aspect of your life. You know, certainly.
You're absolutely right.
Well, tell you what, you know, before we get going, I always have this thing. I like to ask 7 questions, and it's just me, a little goofiness, like
sure.
Something I like. I gives a little extra insight and a little fun. One of the first question I always like to ask is, what is your favorite comfort food? That thing you miss, or the thing that just you're going to sit down. You're not going to care about calories. You're not going to care about. It's just that thing that it brings you back to your center. What would that be?
I think that would probably be a Sunday roast. And in North America, it's kind of difficult to find a pub that does a Sunday roast. And what I mean by that is it could be roast chicken, it could be roast beef, roast lamb, roast pork. But it's, you know, it's a kind of gravy, you know, kind of gravy. And then you've got the potatoes and then you've got the veg. And, you know, it's such a British thing. A Sunday roast, and I really miss that. So
would that be kind of in line like a I don't know, I'm Jewish and I know there's always like a brisket being made, you know, something it's an all day thing.
Yeah,
the grandmother's
exactly.
Basting it, you know.
Yeah, there's something like that. But it's you know, going down to the pub, having a Sunday meal with the family, having Sunday roast and a beer. That's probably what brings me back to my center, if anything.
That's quite civilized. I like that. One of the things I was curious about is if you were to say, you know, 3 people that if you can sit down, cup of coffee or tea, you know, I can go high tea, whatever have you. If you could choose 3 people It could be living or, hey, anybody in history, if you would like, that you'd like to sit down with and just kind of talk story for a few hours. Who would those three people be?
Oh, my God. Well, David Lean, probably the film director. He's died, sadly, but you said, you know, alive or past. So probably David Lean is someone who's one of my favorite UK English film directors. He directed, you know, Lawrence of Arabia and you know, Dr. Zhivago, and, you know, all those kind of Passage to India, all those kind of amazing epic movies. So probably David Lean. Probably someone like Barack Obama, probably someone interesting like that. You've really put me on the spot here.
That's my job, you see.
Hey, the Queen. It's the Queen's birthday today, Mark. Do you know that? It's the Queen.
I did.
She's 96
years old.
Why would you know that? Come on, you wouldn't know that. But yeah, she's 96. I mean, she has two birthdays, which I have no bloody clue why she has two birthdays every year, but she does. Her age doesn't double every year, but she has a kind of official and unofficial birthday. And I have no idea why, but I think it's her proper birthday today. So she's 96 years old, and she's still doing. She's still doing
96. Now, do they consider that? I guess in the US we call it a federal holiday. Do they consider that a holiday in the UK?
No, I don't think so. Or maybe. Do you know what? We're having a holiday. I think we're having a national holiday in what they're calling the Jubilee, which will be about how many years she's been on the throne, and that's in the summer. So I think we are having an extra holiday then, a national, what they
call
it.
Isn't it coming up on like 70 years or something like that? Or
yeah, probably. I have no idea, but it's just a long damn time. So yeah, so there you go.
Well, that's good. Barack Obama shows up a lot. Like he's one of the, he's kind of like about half the people say Barack Obama.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago. Obviously, we all remember that, you know, when he became president. And it was, I remember watching the TV. I was in London and I was sitting there on my own actually that night. And I watched it all through the night. And it just summed up America, how amazing America can be and how extraordinary it can be. And, you know, how different it can be. You know, it's just an extraordinary place of hope and possibility in America. And I love America for that. And that in that moment, seeing him win was sort of America at its best for me. And, I'd love to talk to him about that.
There's definitely an elevated vibe. You know, definitely America's a place of contrast, you know. But, well, next question I got for you. Who, growing up, who was your celebrity crush when you were growing up?
Oh, my God. My celebrity crush. I have no idea. My celebrity crush, I suppose, I thought Cindy Crawford was pretty incredible when I was growing up. But I also had crushes on sort of actors that I just thought were amazing. You know, I mean, you may know him, but a lot of people won't know him. But this guy, his name is Paul Scofield, and he was just an incredible actor. So for me, I was obsessed with Paul Scofield for a long time. I don't know really.
I think Cindy Crawford lands with a lot of guys of our generation.
Yeah, that was of our generation. It summed up the sort of white T-shirt, sort of, you know, denim jeans, sort of bleached jeans. You know, it was sort of that kind of era, wasn't it? You know, where that kind of, I don't know, it was all a wholesome American sort of, you know, vibe going on. I look now and it was a bit sort of, it was a bit kind of misdirected really. But, you know, hey, we were, you know, products of the 80s and 90s.
Indeed. Happily so. It was a good era, you know.
yeah. The wonder years.
Indeed.
Yeah, exactly.
Next question I got for you is, if you're going to be, I don't know, like a year, you're going to be on an island, exotic island, no internet, none of the digital stuff. It'll be comfortable, you know, but you got to be there for a year. And you can only bring one album and one movie on DVD because there's no streaming, okay? What would that album and what would that DVD be?
Oh, my God. That's really hard. I think I would probably, For me, it would be a live album because I listen to a lot of live albums. It would probably got it would. Do you know what? I always take with me James Taylor. So James Taylor Live, it's a double album. So I'm being a bit naughty because it's got two CDs in the actual
That still
collection.
qualifies.
Okay, so it is a box set, as it were, but it's a double album of James Taylor Live, I think, and it's sort of his. I think it's all his life, all his songs, but from various concerts. And the album is just called James Taylor Live, and it's a fantastic album. And it's something that wherever I go in the world, I have it on my phone. If ever I'm sort of feeling a bit lost, I always just put it on, and it always sorts me out.
It's kind of like your
And as
musical comfort
for
food, I
them,
guess.
yeah, exactly. And as for God, the movie, that's really hard. I mean, one movie, Jesus. I don't know. You know what? It would probably be something sort of comedy based because I just want to probably keep myself amused. I hate to say it, it would probably be Groundhog Day because Bill Murray for me is just amazing, and he's someone I'd like to meet and talk to, Bill Murray, because I'm sure he's got some great stories. So probably something like Groundhog Day. Again, that's showing a kid of the 90s. So yeah, it's probably something kind of crass and slightly stupid, but hey, it's a great movie.
Well, no, we grew up in an era where we had those movies. Like the closest thing we got to it now, which is I adore anything. I probably mentioned this at least once an episode, is Judd Apatow. The kind of movies he does, some of those seemingly ridiculous, kind of like just fun kind of movies like that. Like you look back in Bill Murray's Stripes or, Caddyshack and things like that. I mean, Bill Murray, anything he shows up in, I'm going to buy it no matter what. I mean, I'm going to go see it. But
You're absolutely.
now the next question I got for you, definition of a perfect day for you, from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, the component parts of what a perfect day would be.
God, no telephone, my wife, and a book, probably the sea, near the sea, and good weather, and a really good restaurant not far away, in walking distance from where we're staying, and probably no people, no one else. Yeah, and long walks, and that's kind of it, really, to be
It seems
honest.
like a lot of nice introspection time. It seems like quiet by the sea. I'm kind of feeling that.
Well, I mean, I have two kids under the age of five, so right now I don't get much of that. So that's kind
Well, you
of
just wait. You're going to miss those days. Believe it or not, I've got a 19, a 17, and a 16-year-old, and I remember like.
Oh my God, I mean, funny enough, there's a place in Vancouver Island. If any of your listeners ever go to Vancouver Island and they want somewhere interesting to stay, there's a place called. It's a kind of a crazy name. It's called Place No Place. Literally, Place No Place. And it's on Vancouver Island. And you go and you can sort of rent a very kind of simple cabin overlooking the sea. No, sorry, it's not called Place No Place. I'm so sorry. Let me start again. This place is called Point No Point.
Point, no
That's
point.
what it's called. Point No Point. And that's the place where I found going. Having my sort of time off and quiet time with my wife. It's a very special place. So if you ever get a chance, go and visit Point No Point.
We're in that summer vacation planning phase, three teens trying to get them all to collaborate on like what did they decide that they want to do. And
Oh
so
my gosh.
I'm
Right,
tempted to
right.
say, we're just going to go to Canada.
Yeah, listen, go to Point No Point.
You know, the greatest thing with your family, I found that I've had a lot of experiences, as you have in life. I think it's fun with the kids to have experiences that none of y'all have had. You get to have that time together for the first time. Everybody's having that first experience. We'd kind of touched on it before, but if you weren't doing this for a living, they said, okay, no more TV, no more theatrical, no more stages, no more movies, no more acting. It's just not possible. What would you be doing for a living?
Restoring old Land Rovers, Series 2 Land Rovers, just restoring the old Land Rovers and bringing them back to life. yeah, that's probably about it.
Very good. It's working with your hands. I like that. Like it. Now, the last question, speak of another vehicle, DeLorean, you can time travel, and you're going to zip back to when you're 16 years old, and you're going to offer up a piece of advice for 16-year-old you that's going to kind of smooth out the path a little bit for the coming years. What would that piece of advice be to 16-year-old Rupert?
Not worry so much and take more risks. I think in life, I just, worrying is, one of the most pointless activities that I end up doing a lot of. And actually, I think, your real worries happen on a quiet Wednesday afternoon when you least expect it and the phone rings and then suddenly there's an emergency and there's a real worry. And the rest of it really doesn't need worrying about. And so I suppose I would tell him not to worry so damn much, because it's a complete waste of damn time. And also, if he learns and works out how to not worry, to give me a call and let me know how he did it, because
isn't that something?
I ain't got a clue.
No, that theme has come up a number of times. It's something I think of if I was to go back and do the same thing, is the stresses that you come, I'll correlate it like this. I remember waiting tables once, and I remember, if anybody's worked in the service industry,
we've all done that.
Yeah. Is that initial feeling when you get that, you're working a double, you're getting slammed. It's like that stress. And I remember it's like second or third day, and I was on my own doing it. And I talked to the manager. I was like, oh man, it's so stressful. He's like, sit down. Let me tell you something. Stress is being a parent and having three young kids and not having enough food to feed them and not worrying about where to live. He started going down all these really big adult kind of things. He's like, this isn't stress. It's like, you're going to get it. Don't worry. And it kind of reframed some things going, okay, this is a task. This is a skill. This is something I will learn. It's a bumpy road to get there, but it kind of put things in the frame. It was kind of it's kind of funny. Those little nuggets of wisdom don't always come from some, Buddhist monk or something like that. Somebody you just run across as that little piece of info you need to hear in that moment, but not stressing. Yeah, yeah. But then again, a lot of times it's easier said than done. But if you find out, please shoot me an email. Let me know.
Right. Me too, my friend. But take risks and not worry so much, because it kind of all works out.
Well, Rupert, man, I appreciate it so much, you being so generous with your time, especially having just landed back home, unpacking with boxes all around. You are a mensch, my friend. I appreciate it. Much health, happiness, prosperity to you, my friend. Hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up down the line and give those kids a hug and enjoy being back home.
I will. And same. And listen, thanks for having me on. I honestly, it's a great show of yours. And I thank you. And I hope we do it again on the next one. So I'll enjoy and look forward to seeing you and catching up.
Well, there you go. Rupert Evans. What a cool guy. I really appreciated the opportunity to sit down with him and chat. I have a newfound appreciation of Land Rovers, not going to lie. Check out his Instagram. And of course, if you go to storyandcraftpod.com, I'll have the link for you. Likes him some Land Rovers. Just thought that was kind of cool. All right, so there you go. Again, storyandcraftpod.com. Just head there if you want to follow the show. Appreciate you listening, naturally. Like I mentioned, storyandcraftpod.com. Head there, you'll get all the information and links on Rupert, as well as everything about the show. The Story and Craft newsletter, if you'd like to sign up. If you want to shoot me a note, by all means, please do follow and like the show. Leave a review if you would. Again, I really appreciate you coming back by each week for both episodes we're doing every week. It's a lot of fun to make this show for you, and I do appreciate the notes. So there you go. That's it for this episode. Very much looking forward to connecting with you next time, right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.